एक मिनट रुक जाओ, रेडी होने दो। चलो ये कर लेते हैं, दिस कुड बी अ ग्रेट इंट्रो।
हाय, आई एम अक्षय।
हाय, दिस इज सौरभ एंड यू आर लिसनिंग टू द फाउंडर थीसिस पॉडकास्ट। वी मीट सम ऑफ द मोस्ट सेलिब्रेटेड स्टार्टअप फाउंडर्स इन द कंट्री
एंड वी वांट टू लर्न हाउ टू बिल्ड अ यूनिकॉर्न।
हाय, आई एम दीप्ति, आई एम द को-फाउंडर एंड सीईओ ऑफ कोडो।
If you are or have been a startup company or even an SME, you would know the hassles of making online spends using your personal credit card instead of a corporate one because you don't have one yet. Deepti Sanghi not only recognized this need but also solved it by launching the revolutionary Kodo, the credit card for startup which gets approved within 3 minutes. Deepti was born and brought up in Delhi. She graduated from the prestigious LSR College and did her MBA in finance from MDI. Listen to her as she tells host Akshay Dutt about her placements right after MBA and her journey of building Kodo.
From campus, you got into SBI Caps.
Yes, that's right. So what happened was I went on an exchange program to Germany in the second year, in the fifth term. And until then, I wasn't pretty sure what I wanted to do. And this was in HHL in Leipzig. And there we kind of, so that's, I think, one of the top two schools in Germany. And all the investment banks and consultancies come there and they really woo the students there to join them. So they have these parties that the biggest investment bank would throw for the students there to get the best of the crop. And they would have these elaborate presentations. And so, in fact, they had this one day when they, invited all the women in the batch to, this was Morgan Stanley, invited them to go to Frankfurt and look at, and be inside an investment bank. Because during those times, I mean, there was this whole thing about, and even now, right, about diversity of having more women in investment banking, which is predominantly a male-dominated industry, at least then, right? And so we went to the Morgan Stanley office in Frankfurt, and we kind of interacted with the women bankers there, and you know, it became a legit career option. And so that kind of opened up my eyes around investment banking. And I was like, hey, I want to do this. Okay, so then when I came back, of course, we apply for all kind of jobs, right? You don't know which one you're going to get, marketing and finance. I did have this, thing, and which is what like those snooty finance people have. Hey, we're not going to sell soaps, right? That's how you start your career in sales and marketing. I'm not going to go door to door selling soaps. And then, okay, I'll do like this finance thing. And so I think that's what I did. By the way, like life comes full circle, right? Earlier, I was like, I'm not going to sell soaps. Now I'm selling credit cards, which is worse. I kind of sat for all the interviews, and SBI Caps at that point was the only investment bank where you had a front-end role. You know, we did have other like JP Morgan, and I think that was another investment bank that came, but that was mostly around the research part of it. So SBI Caps was the only investment bank who came on campus where we would be in the front end, where we'd interact with clients and be on the team that's actually advising the companies for, you know, M&A or fundraising activities. So I got that.
So what role does an investment bank play? Like, why do clients come to iBanks? Like, you know, what are the things that you would have been offering to clients?
Okay. So in investment banking, you have like two, three different things, right? So one is advisory, which is what I used to do, where let's say if a company wants to acquire another company and they want to evaluate a bunch of options and decide what valuation to do, what should be the deal terms. So that was one. Or if a company wants to sell themselves, right? So buy and sell is M&A. And second is if they want to raise a private equity round of funding, which is largely for growth companies, right? Where you're looking to raise a few hundred crores and you are profitable and a high growth trajectory. Well, now startups are raising a few hundred crores, which are not profitable, but that's another story. At least then, this was around 2005, is what, you know, that is what we were doing. The second part of investment banking, which comes under equity trading, is more of stock trading and being, you know, a trader on the stock markets. Or the research. So all the research reports around listed companies that comes into play. And the third thing is taking a company IPO, right? So where a company is ready to list on the stock exchanges and you kind of interact with the regulators, the exchange, the potential investors and put it all together and you know, help the company list. So those are the three main things I can think of right now, but it's been a while and I'm kind of, you know, I've been in investment banking for quite a few years now, but so I was in the advisory part of it. Yeah.
And how was that experience? Was it as glamorous as you imagined it while you were in Germany?
Yes, it was, right? So of course there's a lot of work and very long work hours, working on weekends. I think all of that stays, right? And for me it was okay because I am a bit of a workaholic in that sense. So I was kind of all right with that. And it came naturally. And, you know, it's pretty heady as well, right? So when you're meeting, you know, you're in your mid-20s, you're meeting these CXOs and founders of these large companies who have built things from scratch, and you kind of just, you know, are advising them or at least helping, you know, put together their financials and, you know, kind of are in the same room. Even if I'm not advising them, at least I'm there and I feel like I'm a part of this, like, you know, environment. So in that sense, it's pretty glamorous and heady, right? And in fact, I remember the day I left my investment banking, I was feeling like, you know, these are like these nice corridors of our office and I'm walking into an important meeting. I'm like, okay, I'm going to leave all of this. And for so I did feel that tug internally, that really, but I guess it is glamorous. And of course, it's a lot of hard work, which is there everywhere, right? If you want to succeed, I think in any field that hard work is there. But yeah. And of course, this was in 2005, and 2008-09 is when the big crash happened, when being an investment banker was like a bad word. Yeah, and it's kind of funny, you know, it's a few months before the crash, there was like an episode on TV around investment banking as a career, and my company nominated me to kind of be featured there. And that was like a big joke, right? Where the whole thing starts with me looking into the sea, because we were in Nariman Point in Bombay, right? So it starts me looking into the sea, and the next day after this was aired, the head of investment banking, and by the way, he's the one who nominated me, he comes and he's like, he's laughing at me, he's like, you know, she's like the poster child of investment banking, she's looking into the sea, and that's what investment banking is right now. We're all at sea, we don't know what's happening. This was like a couple of months before the Lehman crash, so I think the early warning signs were there. And so this was the period when it was super hot. At the same time, immediately after that, it kind of crashed. And I mean, in India, it was not. India basically felt the tremors of the shock that happened in the US. So it was not really something that was intrinsic to the way we were working. But suddenly, it was, you know, from becoming very glamorous, it was more like, okay, you make a lot of money here. And you know, you kind of... but I think that's the nature of the job when you're dealing with like a large amount of capital, like advising companies on, you know, hundreds of thousands of crores, and you take a small percentage of that. It's just the nature of the job, right? So in fact, I've kind of moved from investment banking to retail banking in a sense, and I can see why investment banking, you make a lot more money than retail banking. The reason being that the per person contribution to the amount of money that the company makes is so much larger in investment banking, because like a team of three or four people would be advising on thousands of crores of capital, right? Versus in retail banking, you have per employee ticket size of money that's exchanging hands is much smaller.
So you had like a bunch of stints after SBI. You went to Edelweiss and then to 8 Innovate. Yeah. Tell me about
this. Yeah, so Edelweiss was basically, again, investment banking, where I spent a large part of my time focused on advising companies on private equity and M&A transactions. My main focus was in financial services space. In fact, one of the companies I advised in 2008 was a microfinance company, which had a very strong impact on me in the sense that I could really see how, a lending play can actually impact the lives of these women who are entrepreneurs, who are founders in their own right, like very small micro businesses, but how that credit is super important to help them take off. Right. So that had a very deep impact. And you know, along this while, I was always like kind of working on ideas to do something of my own on. I had this thing that, okay, I'm going to do a job. And one of the reasons of investment banking, other than the exposure in Germany, was around that you make money. So I was like, okay, I have a certain number I need to reach in terms of my savings. Once I reach that, then I'm going to do my business because, I thought that that's the right way to do it. And, So that transaction that I did for SKS Microfinance seeded something around like how a credit can help with an entrepreneur or a small business's journey. And I was like iterating on a number of ideas around that. And while I was hoping to reach that, savings number, which I had in mind. And as life has it, I mean, I reached that number and beyond, but, you kind of settle into a comfort zone and a rhythm. And you get addicted to your paycheck. So it was just like, I was like waiting for that idea to hit me. I continued there for a while. And then I, one day I just was like, okay. And this was like a slow period, right? When things were kind of slow. And in investment banking, you always have these extreme highs and lows, right? When there's a lot of work suddenly and you don't like have any day off versus you might have a few days when you're kind of cooking a deal or, pitching and stuff like that. So this is probably one of those days when, and given that I'm kind of addicted to work, I was probably just restless. And I said, okay, let's just, figure out what next. And I took the plunge. And initially, for a couple of years, I was kind of doing angel investing. I got married and moved to the US for about a year. And I was dabbling in a few startup ideas, investing in them in the fintech space, right? And then...
You moved to the US because your husband was there?
Yeah,
or?
That's right, yeah. And and there I kind of met some of the most successful fintech startups and met with the and that's when I realized it's so easy to meet the CEOs and of large companies and kind of understand what they're doing if you just ask, right? Because when the company is large enough, the CXOs usually have time. And if they see they can help you in any way, at least in the US, I saw they were very generous, right? So, I kind of understood the fintech ecosystem there and, was dabbled a bit in cryptocurrency ideas in terms of investing in them, evaluated a few of them. Didn't buy much Bitcoin, unfortunately, but yeah.
In this period, you were using your own money all these things.
That's right. Yeah, remember I'd crossed my number that I had. So I think that's what happened. And then I decided to come back and start a venture, which was around offering credit to small businesses in India. And there was a digitization happening where businesses were selling online on Amazon, Flipkart. So I was like, hey, what if we can offer credit to them? And I knew this has to be a tech play because that is when you can actually reach scale in a short period of time. And so while I was kind of working on that, I realized that I was really out of my depth in terms of how to use tech to do this, right? It was just something, and I did not have the network in the tech space because I come from investment banking and I within my own an MBA before that, right? So not even an engineering school. So I just did not have like the network to leverage to, you know, or to even like kind of understand how to go about it. And this was also fairly new in India then. So around that time, I had the opportunity to work with MoneyTap, which is a fintech company based in Bangalore. And they were looking for, so I know the founder, Bala, really well. And he used to keep coming to Bombay because you have to work with banking partners. So he said he wanted somebody to manage those banking partnerships. And, you know, I thought this was a perfect fit where I kind of bring the banking relationships and the understanding I have of the financial ecosystem and, you know, kind of be the bridge between Bombay and Bangalore, so to speak. So I was literally living between these two cities for about 2.5 years. I joined the team that like at a very early stage. So I remember the day before I joined, I was actually launched into a large meeting with a partner bank that was a kickoff meeting for us to kind of figure out the product and take it ahead. Yeah, so...
MoneyTap was doing the same thing, like they were lending to SMEs.
So MoneyTap, the product was similar, but the target customer is salaried individuals. So they don't do businesses, right? So yeah, so we kind of launched that, and I would live between the two cities, kind of marry the financial and the risk side of the business that the banks look at from, with the technical and the extreme customer focus side of a tech startup that the team in Bangalore was looking at. So that was an amazing experience. I had so much to learn. I kind of, going into MoneyTap, I didn't know what is back end, front end of engineering, right? Just like it was just like words. And then that kind of really got into the guts of the tech platform, the legacy systems, the banks, and see how to, you know, change them or not, you can't change it. I mean, there are certain ways around it where how to modify certain flows so that our customers get the experience that we want them to, which is like a quick, like get loan instantly, right? If you're applying for a loan, get that approval in like 2 minutes. How do you do that? Right. And this was in 2016, and it wasn't, I mean, right now, I think there is a lot of work that's gone into it already and successful. But then it was kind of the first of its kind, right, to actually even implement that. So those were like amazing years where I actually, and Bala, who's the, you know, co-founder and CEO, he has built multiple companies in the past and sold them. And he's a very successful VC as well. So I had tons to learn from him in terms of, you know, how to lay the foundation of the right team and how do you, the best practices of running a startup and of course the whole product and tech around it. And so that was a very important milestone in my journey.
Okay. And how did MoneyTap grow in your stint with them? Like what kind of numbers did you see, or, you know, was it like an explosive growth kind of a phase?
So I think we launched beta, I think in June 2016. And I think September, October 2016 is when we kind of launched it in the market. And of course, there is like an endless demand for credit, right, anywhere. So, and the product is so powerful. I remember we had this chat-based interface to onboard a customer. So there was a Q&A happening where you answer questions instead of filling a form, right? So that was like pretty cool. We were the first ones to do that. And I think over the next 2 years, if my memory serves me right, we were probably disbursing $50 million. So we had disbursed $50 million worth of credit in that period. So, and we partnered with RBL Bank for that. And then there were a few other partners that we had. And we were also expanding. I mean, by the time I was leaving, we were working on expanding to outside India, to a couple of geographies there. And I think they've gone live in one of them now. So yeah, it was, this was a good phase of launching and scaling a product at MoneyTap.
So, you know, what made you want to move on?
So I think I kind of had seen the journey of a startup from scratch, right, to a stable, scaled, it was still growing rapidly, and a scaled business. And I was like, hey, this was basically a flexible credit for salaried people, right? And my vision was always to do something for other businesses, right? Kind of now when I think back, I can join the dots, right? That I grew up in that environment. A lot of formative years were around books, around these stories. And like even the best part of investment banking was that you're kind of working closely with the founders and really understanding how they build something from scratch, right? I used to love visiting factories because as part of investment banking, when you're advising companies, it's a part of due diligence where you go and visit a factory or the production setup. And I used to love that, especially like steel factories. They were full of, you know, like dirt and soot and everything, but it's just that you can see things like being built there, right? And I don't know, for me, it was like the best part of doing a deal. And so there was a constant thread that was running. And I was like, hey, now this product, which we've got here at MoneyTab, which is a flexible credit for salaried people, is actually very relevant for small businesses, right? So, and this is what I wanted to do before MoneyTab as well, but I just didn't know how to do it. So then I was like, okay, now I know it. And, we have an NBFC in the family. I said, okay, let's just leverage that. And now I know how to build the tech and the partnerships and you know, the various pieces of the puzzle that go into giving a frictionless banking experience, and kind of launched into that. I started working on that idea then.
So tell me how you put together all the pieces. Like, how did you have an NBFC in the family, and why does one need an NBFC here? Like, what was the role of that NBFC in
Kodo? The role is when you're providing credit, right? When you're lending, then you need to have a lending license, so to speak. Right.
But you're lending yourself, or you have a banking partner who's lending, and like you are in a way the tech.
Yeah. So I'll come to the current avatar of Kodo, right? But when I started, it was basically a flexible credit line for businesses. So we would be lending ourselves from the NBFC, right, to the other businesses, and you know, we build the tech over that to give an instant approval and a constant line of credit. So basically any business can lend to anybody else, right? But however, as per regulations, if more than 50% of your income is from, you know, financial income or a lending activity, you need to be licensed as a lender, right? So so that's a prerequisite to do this. And so when I started that was a plan, and I tried to I'm a Marwari, and I was like, okay, I have to have my finances clean and clear, separate, right? I said, okay, let me get a separate card for my business expenses because I shouldn't be putting it. And this is the first time I was doing something like this, right? So I was like, okay, I'm not going to put it on my personal card and then get it reimbursed and stuff. I'll just put it on my company card, right? And So we've had very long banking relationships with a couple of top banks, HDFC and ICICI Bank. And I think HDFC kind of didn't even bother to respond after multiple follow-ups. Maybe it's a function of the relationship manager or whichever department we were in. So that was hard. And ICICI Bank, I had to do relentless follow-ups for 3 months to eventually get a corporate card for ourselves, even though our banking account is with them and I've had a personal relationship. Like, I always bank with them, like, since 2005, right? And I have a lot of respect for them. I think they are probably one of the best in terms of customer service, et cetera, and the user interface. But this product was just not something that they were focused on, right? And it was super hard to get. And eventually when I got it, I did not have, like, a net banking access to my credit card statement. They were sending me physical statements and it was linked to my corporate account. So I didn't have to, like, it didn't hurt me because they were just doing automatic debits from the account. So it was fine. I didn't miss it. But still, it was just bizarre. I was getting paper statements instead. I could never log in and see it. So I was like, okay, this is something that I could see was, a pain point. And I had done something like this in MoneyTab where it was a credit card and a credit line product that was, I kind of literally you know, was a part of the team that built it from scratch. I knew the ropes of that. And I said, hey, I mean, this is a great entry point. Let's do this. This is the white space I can see. And let me see if I can put this together, right? If I can do a credit card along with the credit line. Around that time, there were a couple of platforms who kind of, you know, sit between the networks like MasterCard, Visa, and the banks, and kind of have this tech platform that you can plug and play into, right, and launch your own card. So this was really early days. This was 2018, right? And I'm very deep in the fintech ecosystem as such. It's like literally I've been with the system since 2015, and that's when it's been kind of, you know, taking off. So I knew the right people to work with, and then I kind of approached them, and we kind of put the pieces together that, okay, this is how this is going to work. You know, this is a bank we'll partner with, and we'll have MasterCard, and you know, we'll have this company that, you know, our company that would run the program, acquire customers, etc. So I think that's how it started. Now I still needed somebody on the tech bit, because this is fairly tech intensive, and I was
had already built an instant credit product, right? Like, so you must have got somebody to do that for you. Like at this stage, you already had like a credit product, right? Oh, like where you were lending.
No. So no, I did not have that. At least in my company, I did not have that, right? So I was, it was not, I identified the people that who would be building it, but they were all outsourced.
The chronology is that the credit card and the credit line both got launched together, is it? Like, while you were working on the credit line, the credit card idea also came to you, and then you kind of redrew the business plan. And,
that's right. Got it. Right. And one of the things I had in terms of like tech thing was that I'm based in Mumbai, right? And so it was kind of hard to build that, you know, tech team in Mumbai at that point in time, because most of that talent is in Bangalore, and you know, it was just a little bit difficult, but still at least I knew what I was looking for in that person, right? So it's interesting, I reached out to Gaurav, who's now my co-founder and CTO, on LinkedIn and this was in I think late 2018. And we connected. So now, in fact, when I tell people I met Gaurav on LinkedIn, they give me a disdainful look, and they're like, "Oh, it's like saying you found your husband on Tinder," you know? I'm like, look, that's not too bad, right? Because I have friends who have found their, you know, life partner on Tinder, and it's worked beautifully. And well, it's worked really well for Gaurav and I as well. You know, you should ask him though.
What's his background? Like, tell me about Gaurav.
So before this, he was a part of a startup in the US, which was basically a kind of a LinkedIn stroke GitHub for security professionals, right? So like tech security professionals. And I was like, this is great, because, and prior to that, he had worked in a number of startups like I think Apna Paisa and Holiday IQ, Media Melon, Atos Origin, so very strong tech background. And I found his profile attractive because he had worked for security professionals. And I was like, for a fintech product, that is super important, right? It was as simple as that. And I was like, okay, let's meet and figure it out. And then we met in Jan 2019, right?
He was in Mumbai
He was in Mumbai. And we kind of, so when I was telling him about my vision for what we wanted to build here, he was like, he articulated it perfectly, right? Because he'd been in a number of startups and he could understand the pain point of this. And he found an immediate connect there. And he agreed to come on board as an advisor, right? So he, I mean, and remember, we'd met on LinkedIn, right? So you're like, and I know, I mean, as being an angel investor in startups, I know the biggest cause for any startup to fail is founder conflict, right? And I was like, I don't want to deal with that. So unless I'm pretty sure about this person, I'm not going to like commit, right? So So yeah, so and the same thing with Gaurav as well. He was also he's got very high EQ, right, and IQ obviously, and he was also very aware of this fact and
very rare in a
I think I touched what I got super lucky, right? And he kind of agreed to come on board as an advisor, and then he was there with us for the next few months while we were getting this built. And August 2019 is when he decided to come on board full time. I think he kind of said, okay, I'm safe to work with. And he took the plunge. And we launched our product in December 2019 with our first real, I mean, we our product was live, I think, in September. But for the next 2-3 months, we were just doing intense testing, just doing transactions ourselves internally. We gave it to like 2-3 people. Because this is at the end of the day, it's a credit card, right? I mean, you are swiping the card somewhere, there's a transaction happening. And then as you go down into the payments rabbit hole, you see that, okay, there are just so many like scenarios that can occur for any given transaction that, you know, we're testing it like intensely. And then in December, we had a first real customer who finished the first full month of, like, where we issued like the first statement, the credit card statement was in January. Yeah.
So your original idea that you were to do the lending yourself, so that you pivoted from that into partnering with a bank who would
the lending is still there, right? So whatever you spend on the cards, right, is on the bank. But at the same time, we also have an option where you can take credit. Like you can say, okay, so let's say you've got a credit limit of 5 lakh rupees, right, and you've spent, let's say, 2 lakhs a month on your various online spends. So be it, let's say, Facebook or Google marketing or AWS or server costs or various ID subscriptions, etc. Now you still have 3 lakhs of credit limit left with you. So what you can do is you can say, and if you need working capital, short-term credit for 3 months, 6 months, you can say, hey, I need one lakh for 6 months. So you can go and, you know, select that amount and the tenure for which you need that working capital. And the money goes into your bank account instantly. Right. And then your EMIs start on that. And so that is the lending part that the NBFC is doing. Right. So that is going from the NBFC's book.
And that gets adjusted against your credit limit. Like your credit limit would go down by that.
Yeah. Okay. And then the EMI gets added to your statement and you can.
So how did you convince a bank to partner with you? Like, was it a tough sell or like because of your connections, you were able to do it easily?
Yeah, I think one is the credibility, right? So given that I had built something like this, I knew the language to speak and I knew the risk and what is it that the banks are concerned about. So I kind of knew that language and that kind of helped. And of course, the experience of being in MoneyTap and doing this, I think that really helped. And so I think, you know, like for a bank, the most important thing is that, you know, So banks are actually in India very open to partner, right, with fintech startups, which is incredible, right? Because they understand what is it that they can do and what is it they can't, right? So I know what is it that banks are most concerned about. Of course, they need growth, like anybody does, but they are very compliance first, right? Which is how they are designed to be, given that they're regulated by RBI very strongly, and given that they are the custodians of all the deposits, the savings and FDs that all of us keep with the banks, right? So, I mean, they have to ensure that the banks don't fail because all of our hard-earned money is there. So those are the two things that they are most concerned about, right? So not to take overdue risk so that it depletes the amount of money with them. And second is be compliant with RBI regulations, right? And once you respect that and you know, kind of, so that's one part of the thing. And the second part on the customer end is that now because banks are compliance first, they find it hard to make a radical shift where the customer gets an instant banking experience. Now, some banks are actually doing that, right? But for a new customer, a new-to-bank customer, it is super hard for them. So, and there is a lot of legacy that's already there, which has been built compliance first. So I mean, eventually there will be some banks that will be able to do a great job of marrying the compliance and regulatory aspect with the customer experience of instant credit or instant financial product. Eventually that'll happen, but it's not happened yet. And that's where the opportunity is for fintech startups or tech companies to come in and take care of the customer side of the experience, right? That's why we exist. But at the same time, we have to run on a bank's or regulated entity's rails, right? So that's where the magic lies, right? That's where the art of this is, that how do you do that? And for that, you need extreme empathy on both sides.
So in your 2-minute approval process, like how do you do the credit risk assessment? Like what all data points do you look at? Are you at liberty to talk about that?
Yeah, I can talk about it. I mean, it's fairly simple, right? So when it comes to credit, there are two things. There's nothing new about it. It's been like there for ages, is the intent and ability, right? So the intent is basically whether you as a borrower are honest and have high integrity and whether you will repay if you had the ability to repay, right? And the second is the ability, is like, whether you can afford to take this amount of credit, right? So it's like if somebody is making an income of, let's say, 10 lakhs and I give them a credit of 2 crores, it's obviously like they don't have the ability to service that, right? Unless it's like a 50-year or 30-year loan, right? So those two things, very basic, nothing new. Now, how do you address that, right? So intent is basically, now we are at a journey where there's a lot of credit history already for a lot of borrowers out there. So based on the credit history and the past credit behavior, you can understand whether this person's intent is correct or not. If somebody has defaulted a lot in the past, then you know, okay, this person's either intention's wrong or is irresponsible, right? So
these algorithms you had to make from scratch, or are these like, available off the shelf? All this decision making, mm-hmm. which you do, like how did you build that up?
So we built it from scratch, right? And I had the experience of doing this at MoneyTap, where I was working closely with the risk teams of banks, and I knew what is it that is required in these algorithms, right? So I knew the business requirement and the product requirement of this. And then, of course, Gaurav coded it into building those algorithms. However, these algorithms are available to buy, but they're very expensive, so we didn't take that up.
So December you kind of went live. So tell me the journey from December to now. We are hitting December soon. Yeah. So what's this year been like for you?
Yes, so we went live in December. The next 2 months obviously growing rapidly, 100% growth, right? And this was through our own network and people who took the product initially, they loved it. And again, people didn't know about this kind of a product, right? A lot of people don't know there's something called a corporate credit card, right? So we saw very good offtake until Feb, and then mid-March, the lockdown hit us, right? And there were already so March is when we kind of, decelerated a bit. And April was the first lockdown month when everything came to a standstill. So we were again down in April. And so that April is when we took the time to really talk to a lot of our customers and understand what is the most important thing on their mind, right? So what is it that's top of mind for them? Now, everybody's business is shut, right? So everybody's thinking, okay, when will this lockdown end? How do I increase my sales? How do I sell? I have this, these expenses. And it was an interesting thing where a lot of these businesses that were cash flow businesses, they didn't fire anybody, right? They, especially the smaller businesses, they kind of kept everybody on board because it was more like family, right? Like the founders felt guilty of firing people. And of course, there was also this thing that, this thing with like lockdowns only for a month or something. And so for them, that was the top of the mind thing. And what we did and then was that we said, hey, what if we can, and around that time, we were thinking of starting some social media campaigns and stuff, because we had been really under the radar throughout, right? We just wanted to keep growing the product and not really like do PR or, you know, any kind of make any noise, because we were just kind of working hard on getting customers, understanding their need, building the product, iterating. So that time, and when the lockdown hit, we were actually thinking of some ideas. Okay, how do we start activate our like social media? So we said, hey, you know, our customers need this. They need more awareness of their products. They want to sell more. So we started a campaign called the Heartbeat Campaign. The idea being that these businesses are the heartbeat of the economy and we got to keep them running. And we started, posting stories of the founders and the companies and, publicizing their product to in whatever small way. We are too small. We don't have a large audience, but we said, okay, whatever small way we can do that and drive people to their websites and help them increase their sales. Luckily for us, a lot of our customers fell in the essential services category, right? Like some of the large names that we have as customers are Epigamia, Blue Tokai, Urban Platter, Dr. Vedas. These are all like companies that fall in the essential services category. So they could technically sell, but their whole supply chain and operations on the ground were stuck, right? And they could not. So offline retail channels were shut. And I think Amazon and Flipkart and Big Basket were also shut for about a month, largely because of the operational complexity on the ground. They didn't know how to source stuff, right? So then all of these guys activated their own e-commerce websites where they started selling directly on their channels, because until then they were getting a lot of demand from the larger e-commerce players and through the offline channel. So they started getting traffic there, and then they started spending on Google and Facebook to drive traffic to their websites, right? And suddenly in May, we started seeing a lot more spends happening on our card. And we're like, okay, what happened, right? Suddenly, I mean, because the lockdown continued. And we're like, okay, what's changed? And we looked at our data and we saw, okay, these companies are spending more on like digital marketing. And while we were talking to them, they also said that, hey, we are driving traffic here. This is where. And then at the same time, they had to service those orders themselves. So they started spending on logistics as well, right? Because earlier the servicing was being done by offline retail or through Amazon, Flipkart, etc. Right? So that was like the turning point when we said, okay, now this is something that is where all the spends are going to be. So let's just focus here, right? Prior to that, a large amount of our spends were on travel and food because of business development activities. And that's obviously gone down to zero. Now it's again picking up. But for the last few months, it was zero. And however, this kind of took off and how, right? It kind of literally overshadowed everything else. So that's where the businesses started spending. And as businesses were remote, they were spending on various IT subscription tools to manage remote teams. So that also kind of took off. And, a little exercise of the Heartbeat campaign gave us ideas where we said, you know, we already offer a lot of free credits and discounts from AWS and Freshworks, Message91. Exotel. So a lot of business tools that companies can use. It's almost worth 50 lakhs of free credits that we offer. And we said, hey, why can't like our customers who are also offering various products, they can showcase their products to other Kodo users, right? So we call it the Kodo Club. And we started offering our customers products on that benefits section. So yeah, that was an interesting thing that came out of the lockdown. Two things, right? One is that complete shift in the spend profile on online advertising, and also, this thing where we started offering we gave this like for free, right, to kind of talk about their products on our platform.
So would not an economic downturn also inherently increase demand for credit, because a lot more people would be worried about making ends meet and would be looking for credit, like especially like small businesses, I imagine, which are like very cash flow based.
Yeah, you know, it's it works both ways, right? The thing is, when somebody is like a responsible, and that's where the intent matters a lot, right? When you're responsible and you have high intent, if they see their business is going down or it's shut, they actually don't want to take more credit, right? Because they don't want to be stuck with debt. I mean, credit anyways in India is like, you know, a bad word. So they are kind of like more conscious of the fact that they don't want to be indebted too much, right? Of course, and so I think it'll be interesting to see the data. I don't know that. But at least from our limited data set, we saw that unless that credit is actually helping you increase your sales, you don't want to dip into that because people understand there's a cost attached to it. Right. And that was one of the things which I was pretty clear of when starting this out, that people should take credit only if it helps them enhance their income earning capacity. Right. That's one of the learnings I had from the SKS microfinance days, that, you know, this credit is important to help them increase their income earning capacity. Right. So because there's a cost attached to it. So, I mean, if you're taking credit for consumption, unless it's, let's say if it's a housing loan or a car loan, which is spread over a long period of time, and it's basically you're matching the cash flows of a stable income with a lumpy expense that you have in terms of buying a house or a car, that makes sense, right? Or an emergency that comes in. But if you're funding a lifestyle or let's say a stalled business and you're going on funding the expenses with credit where there's a cost attached to it, then that's not the most prudent financial planning for yourself or your business, right? So that's where you know, we saw that, you know, a lot of our customers were actually quite diligent about it. So now the spendings were happening on online advertising, right? And that is basically a revenue driver. So the more you showcase your product and put it out there, the more it sells. So it's basically like they say, it's a K-shaped recovery, right? Where some businesses are benefiting a lot. So all the businesses who were quickly able to turn around and be digital first and drive traffic, I think they saw a lot of growth. Businesses who were unable to do that, their growth kind of stalled. Thankfully, we had more of the former than the latter. And that helped us grow 12x in the last 6 months, right? So we've been growing at a very strong clip.
Do you think that, you know, with like offline getting hit, the process that you've built of 2-minute online approval would like have like a significant acceptance and preference also as compared to people looking for credit cards with traditional banks as the issuer?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's an important thing. And that's something that's been non-negotiable for me even before the lockdown, right? I mean, that's what my whole journey in fintech started with, that's how it should be. I mean, imagine you can get a full car and a human being in the form of Uber or Ola in like a minute, right? At your service when you tap on an app. Now, and that's like a physical object. So why can't you have like money at the tap of a button, which is just like bits, right? Bits and bytes. So I mean, it's mind-boggling when you kind of compare the two, right? And then you're like, okay, what's going on? Why is it not possible? So I think that was a de facto thing where we wanted to create that journey where it's an instant approval and you can use the product instantly. I think that's always been the North Star. And, you know, like from the very beginning, we had that flow. You know, we didn't take any shortcuts that, okay, let's do this later, etc. I think that's the basic line you need to have in any fintech product right now.
So how do you make money? Like, do you have monthly fees or do you also make money when transactions happen? Like, what are the revenue sources for Kodo?
Yeah, so it's largely through transactions. It's interesting you mentioned that. So like when we pitch to customers and we tell about a product and we say, hey, it's free, then they're like, oh, okay, it's another startup that's just burning money, right? or they feel like, are you sure you can sustain this? Like, does it make sense? And well, they would never ask a bank, right? When they get a credit card, which is kind of free, but they have that empathy for us because I guess they believe that banks should at least offer them like this, if nothing else, right? So I've been like explaining our business model quite a bit to a lot of people. So it works simply, right? So whenever you swipe a card at a restaurant, and let's say you have to pay 100 rupees to the restaurant owner gets 98 rupees or something around that number. and the 2 rupees is shared between a number of players, right? So let's say if you are presenting a card that's issued to you by Citibank, and the merchant, you know, their bank is, let's say, HDFC. So that 2 rupees would be split between Citibank and HDFC, and if your card is on MasterCard, with MasterCard, right? So in our case, we are issuing you the card, or let's say it's a Kodo co-branded card. And so it is split between our banking partner, us, and the merchant's bank and MasterCard. Right. So per transaction is how we make money. We also have like a small setup fees, and eventually, I mean, we're adding a lot of business tools around, you know, managing your expenses and your finances as a business. So as a product evolves more, we'll probably have a freemium kind of a version, where if you want more features, more integrations with your banking or accounting systems, then we'd probably charge some kind of a monthly fee. But that's not there yet. And of course, the interest, right? So if you take a loan on if you take a loan on the credit line, then there's an interest that you.
So this is shared between you and the issuing bank.
Yeah.
The interest. Yeah. Okay. So these additional integrations that you want to build up, like, give me an example. Like, say, instead of manually entering the spend, it would automatically get into your Tally or your Zoho books or whatever, like,
yes,
stuff like
so
that.
That is one example where it can integrate with your accounting system, right? So there are a bunch of more things that we have planned. Like, for instance, there's one part which is free right now, and it'll be, is that you can actually manage your subscriptions, right? So as a founder, what happens is you would have your card put up on a lot of different subscription services. And, you know, often you forget and your card keeps getting hit, right? And so now this is one place where if you have your Kodo cards on various subscriptions, you can see, okay, these are the 5 places where we have a separate tab for that. You can see these are the 5 places where my card is on subscription, and you can block those subscriptions if you'd like and unblock them, you know. So sometimes it happens, and, you know, especially newer SaaS companies, they make canceling a subscription super hard. Right. I mean, they say, okay, call our call center to cancel it. So in that scenario, you can just go in.
Not even like I've been struggling with a LinkedIn charge on my card, my personal card. I wrote to LinkedIn. They have no idea what that charge is about. My own account doesn't show any kind of premium subscription. So eventually I had to like block the card altogether to stop that.
Wow.
Charge.
And you're not able to stop it from LinkedIn.
Yeah, they said, we don't know, like it's not on my account. Like, my personal LinkedIn account doesn't show any charge. So I don't know when I used it. Maybe I used it for an employee or something like that. And I don't do it. So, you know, I've not been able to track that. So
wow. Yeah, it happened to me once, and I wrote to them and I said, okay, I want to cancel my subscription. And somehow when you threaten to cancel subscription, then they reimburse. So maybe that's a small hack you can do. But yeah, so then you should probably put your Kodo card on LinkedIn and everywhere else. Yeah. Then you can block it there if you need to.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is an amazing feature. Yeah. So, how have you been funding it so far?
So, you know, we've deployed our own capital into this so far. And, you know, we got accepted into YC recently. So that gives us a little bit more funding. And then, of course, we plan to raise another round next year.
So tell me about YC. Like, you said YC gives you funding. Like, in what way? Like, YC gives you funding as soon as you get accepted, or they make you like attractive for VCs to fund eventually? Like, what is the value add of?
So they
YC?
Do write a small check, right? They do offer $125,000 as part the moment you join YC, right? And of course, then there's a demo day at the end of the program where you can raise a much larger round. So yeah, so that that is what, and of course, I mean, YC is a lot more than money, right? It's really at least, and for me, it's very new right now, but I'm super excited to be a part of it. And it's just that, you know, you're a part of a tribe where, you know, people are trying to build something amazing in their businesses. And the YC ecosystem has a network of super smart, super successful founders, and the partners themselves have built businesses and scaled them. And they kind of have seen tons of data points, right, of what works, what does not work over, you know, more than a decade. And because that's all they do all the time, right? So it's really something where you can kind of leverage that that experience of so many companies and founders and partners over the last decade or more, and distill that, and they help you in kind of, you know, along the journey. And yeah, I mean, I think what we're excited about is to really tap into that knowledge pool, and that would help us guide us over the next stage of our company. Because I mean, for us, like, you know, our product's ready, we know what's working, we've got the product market fit. It's just about scaling it from here, right? And we're a part of the best in the business to help us do that.
Why did you choose to apply for YC? I mean, you know, there's a cost for everything. Like, there would have been a cost in terms of time spent in doing the application process, which I'm sure must have been significant. So, you know, what made you want to do
so
this?
YC is like the blue chip in the industry, right? When it comes to, you know, a startup. I mean, any startup would, you know, it's like the place to kind of go and be a part of that ecosystem to really modify your business for the next scale up. So I think that's that. And in terms of the application, of course, they have a full set of questions that you have to fill and answer. And, you know, that does take time, but that is like super valuable exercise in itself, whether you make it to YC or not, because they ask very fundamental questions and you have to answer them in plain English and with numbers, right? An important part is that you have to substantiate whatever you're saying with real data, like whether you have a product and the numbers and the metrics, right? So that exercise really kind of, if you do it diligently, of course you can do it in a very you know, superficial way as well, but if you are diligent about that, it really helps you kind of dig deep into your business and answer questions at a very fundamental level and see if that is substantiated by the metrics of a business, right? So I think versus comparing that to building a deck, I think in a deck, anybody is very, you know, as far, so there are all these things, right? In a deck, you should use like an X font, and you should not have more than one idea, and it should not be in like, shouldn't have too much like information overload. So when you're trying to balance like really how the insight that you have about the business and you know, what is it that you're really doing in trying to come up with a one-liner, which can be written in like a size 20 font or something. It's super hard, right? And I think people who have that skill are, I think, exceptional where they're able to do that. But I think just to have that liberty to explain your thought process and in a consistent way, right? So they ask like different questions in the application form. And, you know, it's also, but it's important to have, at least the way I, you know, when I would read my own answers, I would always see, okay, is it consistent? Is it something that I'm actually, and I mean, thankfully for me, it was consistent. I didn't have to do much around it. But if you see any signs of inconsistencies, right, then that's the red flag where you yourself as a founder need to think through it. That, okay, what is it that I'm really doing? And sometimes you don't have those answers, and which is fine, right? Because it's like an early journey. But it at least surfaces those problems, right, in front and center to you. So even if you make it or don't make it, just that exercise is super valuable.
And why do you think YC selected you, or they like shortlisted you?
I don't know. I mean, it's really, I mean, something that I'll get to know over the next few months. But I think attraction is something that was super attractive, right? So, you know, There are a lot of YC. So YC network is super close-knit. They're always out there to help each other. So there were a lot of people who offered to review your application and do mock interviews. So yeah, I mean, from what the alumni told me, a couple of them whom I shared the application form where they were like excellent traction and you know, like, so I think that kind of stood out a lot. And one of the important things, at least from what the partners have told us, that you should have the clear insight into the problem and how are you well equipped to handle it, right? So I'm assuming if they selected us, they probably, you know, were satisfied with that. That the insight into the problem and, you know, our capability to address it was something that they were comfortable with.
What is the origin behind the name Kodo? Like, you know, where did that come from? It's a Japanese word,
yes,
right?
Yes, that's right. Well, the Kodo means multiple things, even in Japanese, depending on the kanji, right? Japanese, like we have... Devanagari, that's called kanji over there. Depending on how you write it, it means multiple things. The meaning that we chose to take is that kodo means the rhythm of the heartbeat, right? And, you know, every transaction a business makes, every expense a business has, is basically a pulse in the life of a business, right? So we said, well... you know, eventually we want to serve businesses by offering them a platform to do all of their financial or banking activities on Kodo. So, you know, we want to be that heartbeat of the business that keeps it running.
But any special affinity for Japan or like it's just like part of a brainstorming exercise?
Oh, no. So, yeah, I don't know. I like Japan a lot. I've, like, normally when I have this thing, I don't visit the same place twice because there's just so much to see in the world and there's only so many years we have. But Japan is one place where I've visited many times. I don't know, some connection there, but I love that country. It's just everything is like a couple of things stand out, right? One is that everything works there, right? It's just everything is so systematic and efficient. And the Japanese people have a lot of empathy. You know, they're just like think through every part of whenever they're designing a product or a service, they think through every touch point. So I think that's always fascinated me. For instance, in terms of how the efficiency of the system is there, right? I'll give you an example. So I went hiking in Japan, you know, in a certain area. I'll come to the name of the place. And you basically are in the interiors of Japan and you take buses to various places. Now, like somewhere in the middle of the small city or a small town, there is, you know, we had the schedule for a bus to come at 7:34 a.m. and the bus was there at 7:34 a.m., right? Not a minute before, not a minute late, right? And it's a bus, it's not a train, right? So that's the level of efficiency. I mean, at one station, like again in the interior somewhere, you have to change multiple trains. My husband had a backpack where he was carrying a lot of like currency, you know, like for our travels. And he left that bag in a train and then we had to change a train and we went somewhere else. After like two changes of the trains, he realized he had left his bag. And 3 hours later, I think 3 or 4 hours later, we got the bag, right? And it was untouched. So, of course, it's a developed country and there's no poverty and maybe that's why we got it back. But it's just, you know, really... like high up there when it comes to ethics and empathy and efficiency, right?
Like civilized, it's like the most civilized country.
Yeah,
probably.
Yeah, and even philosophically, I think there are a lot of things that I relate to. So the hike that we went for is in a region called Kumano Kodo, right? So that's where I heard the word the first time. And so it's basically a pilgrimage and it's very sacred to the Japanese people. So it's like, to draw a parallel, it's like it's a, you know, like India, you have Char Dham Yatra, right? Where you have to go to these four places to before you die, right? To achieve salvation. So they have something similar there called, and it's a walking trail. So it's like walking meditation. You have to go to these like three important shrines and it's a forested and a hilly area. And you walk to them. So in the like I think thousands of years ago, the imperial family used to kind of follow that route to those pilgrimages. So we did that. My husband and I did that, in, I think, December 2018. And it was a most surreal experience. It's like, it's walking meditation, where instead of sitting in one place, you're walking in the forest. And you're kind of hitting up these shrines. And so that's where, I heard the word. And it wasn't like that's when I said, okay, this is the word I'm going to use. But later on, when I was kind of thinking through various options and I could relate back to my period there, it kind of fit in. And in Kumano Kodo, the word actually means something else. It doesn't mean the rhythm of the heartbeat. But when we looked up and we spoke to our Japanese friends, they kind of told us what it means in various forms, and we picked that up.
So something similar happened with me. My business is called right. Unnati. So, it was something similar. I incidentally came across the name and I loved it. And then later on, of course, you justify that, okay, this is Unnati means progress.
Yeah.
Like, these things often are there's a gut connection with the word at times.
It surfaces later, right? It's not like in the moment you're like, a light bulb goes on and you're like, okay, this is it. It's something that kind of surfaces later and you kind of find that connection.
So that was Dipti telling us how her fintech idea led her to developing Kodo. To apply for a Kodo credit card, log on to their website www.kodo.in. That is www.kodo.in.
Like the Founder Thesis podcast, then do check out our other shows on subjects like marketing, technology, career advice, books, and drama. Visit thepodium.in, that is thepodium.in, for a complete list of all our shows.